This episode of China Money Podcast is sponsored by Lehman Brown, a China accounting, audit, and advisory firm. Golden Gate, a law firm providing a full range of legal services in China. Covert Limited, a leading internet privacy tool. And 51mice.com, a comprehensive online platform for meetings, incentives, conferences, and exhibitions in China. Please go to our website, ChinaMoneyNetwork.com, and click on our sponsors links. Thank you so much, everyone, for your support. Hi, everyone. Welcome to China Money Podcast. I'm your host, Nina Xiang. Our guest today is Mark Faber, editor and publisher of the Gloom, Boom, and Doom Report. Dr. Mark Faber was born in Zurich, Switzerland. He studied economics at the University of Zurich and at the age of 24 obtained a PhD in economics, magna cum laude. Since 1973, he has lived in Hong Kong, and from 1978 to 1990, he was a managing director of Jackson Burham Lambert. In 1990, he established Mark Faber Limited, which acted as an investment advisor and fund manager and has lived in Chiang Mai, Thailand. Dr. Faber publishes a widely read monthly investment newsletter, The Gloom, Boom, and Doom Report, which highlights unusual investment opportunities. He is also the author of several books, including Tomorrow's Gold, Asia's Age of Discovery. He talked with me in his house in Chiang Mai, Thailand last week, and here is our conversation. Hope you enjoy it. Hi, Mark. Welcome to China Money Podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your program.
We are in your beautiful house Chiang Mai in northern Thailand, and the walls here are all covered with pictures of Cultural Revolution.
Yes.
And also the Maoist China period.
Yes.
So obviously you're focused on China. Tell us, what do you think the Chinese economy is doing right now?
Well, basically, in order to understand China, you have to go back a long time. And as you know, we had the revolution and then the power of Mao Zedong. And then he died in 76. And by 78, Deng Xiaoping then began to open up the country. And initially, it was an experiment. But later on, it was extended to the whole of the country, and the growth in China between 1990 and especially after 2000 up to today has been mind-boggling, and China's impact on the global economy has been mind-boggling. Just consider, in 1980 China consumed 2% of all global industrial commodities as a percent of total global consumption. And by year 2000, it was 12%, and now it is 47%. So essentially 47% of all industrial commodities in the world are consumed by China. And this explosion of growth had obviously a huge impact on other emerging economies, the resource producers in Latin America, in Africa, Central Asia, the Middle East, and Australasia. And now the growth in China is obviously slowing down, so it backfires on the countries that supply China with all kinds of resources. But if you look at the economic history of the US, 1800 to today, we had in the 19th century already 19 recessions. And we had a civil war, then came World War One, the Depression years, World War Two, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and the country continued to grow. So I wouldn't be too worried about Chinese a problem in the near term. I think it's solvable. Hopefully it is painful, because China needs, a society needs from time to time some pain. And then then the economy takes off again. Without pain, you essentially misallocate a lot of capital and you bail out rotten enterprises and so forth. So the pain will be there for sure. But equally, China has the ability to ease monetary policies. And so what has happened, the economy has been essentially decelerating very strongly, but the stock market is up almost 100% from the lows last year. And this was my theory, that the economy, yes, I'm bearish about the Chinese economy, but the stocks can go up.
Where specifically do you think the pain will be?
Well, obviously in the housing market, there are lots of housing developments that will not have positive returns. We have also excess capacities in some basic industries, steel and other basic materials. That's where the pain will be. And obviously, you know, if you look at China as a country with, say, close to 1.3 billion people, that is twice the size in terms of population of the US and Europe. So you have some provinces in China that are as large as Italy or France. And what can happen in China is that some areas of the countries continue to grow, some sectors grow and others contract, and some companies will fail and others will prosper. But this is in the process of capitalism, this is important, that you not only have success, that you have failures, and the failures are then eliminated, and that makes the industry or the country more efficient.
So it seems like you do think that China is actually doing the right thing, which is to change its economic growth model through an economic slowdown.
Yes, I mean, we have to see how far Xi Jinping can essentially carry out his policies, because as you know, corruption not only in China but in other countries is very endemic, and to really get rid of it would be a huge achievement. And but I think he's on the right path. I think that China has to also consider the qualitative aspect of economic development and not only the quantitative aspect. In other words, say in Europe there's no growth, but I have had discussions with academics there and they say, yes, we have no growth, but the quality of life has improved. So you could have essentially an economy where there isn't much improvement statistically, but there is a qualitative improvement, and that should happen in China in particular. They should, let's say, pay more attention to environmental issues and pollution and stuff like this.
You mentioned the property market as a potential trouble area in China. What are some other risks do you think the Chinese economy face?
Well, the biggest risk is that the property market is a symptom of the problem. The problem is that credit has grown far more than economic activity. So your debt to GDP has increased dramatically. And during this period of debt to GDP growth, you essentially borrow from the future. You borrow economic growth from the future. So once the debt level reaches a level where it's difficult to continue to increase at the same pace, the economy automatically slows down. But I have to point out, this is not only endemic to China, but also to many other Asian countries where the household debt as a percent of the economy has grown a lot. Secondly, what is frequently missing in the discussion of credit is what is credit used for? In other words, if you look at Korea in the 50s, 60s and 70s, or Japan, 50s, 60s, 70s, they were highly leveraged economies. They borrowed a lot of money and they had poor credit ratings. But the credit was used for capital spending, infrastructure, the construction of plant and equipment, education, and research and development. That credit then generates, say, you borrow money to build a factory, and the factory then produces goods or services, and that generates a cash flow, so the interest on the debt and the debt can be repaid from your cash flow. The worst type of credit is what the US has, is consumer credit, where people borrow to buy a car, or they borrow to buy a washing machine or a TV set or whatnot, and that then becomes burdensome for the household, because that machine, the washing machine, doesn't generate any income for the household. And so that kind of credit has a negative impact in the long run, whereas credits used for infrastructure are in general to be positively viewed. And also I have to mention, some people will argue, well, that China has overbuilt, you know, roads and tunnels and bridges and trains and so forth. But I don't see it that way. In America, in the 19th century, in other words, as the economy began to industrialize, we had the construction of canals and of railroads. The railroadization of America was a huge thing. And the transportation network was built. All the canal companies, including the most successful canal ever built, the Erie Canal, went bankrupt, all of them. And 95% of railroads had to be refinanced or also went bankrupt. But the US then had the railroad network, and they had the roads and they had the canals. So that facilitated then trade. You understand? The companies themselves didn't do well, but they were there that and enabled the industries in America to grow. America is one of the few countries in the world where you can go into practically any city, from San Diego to San Francisco, Los Angeles, Houston, Dallas, Milwaukee, Chicago, and so forth. They are all over the country industries because they have the transportation network. You go to Indonesia, industries are concentrated basically in Jakarta and in Surabaya. In Thailand, it's all concentrated south of Bangkok in the corridor to Chonburi. So these countries have a disadvantage vis-a-vis the US, that they had a huge market, they had industries in different parts of the countries, and so commerce could grow very rapidly. And that China is doing right. India doesn't do that. Infrastructure in India is a catastrophe.
Right. So it does sound like you're not too concerned about the debt problem after all.
Well, I'm of course concerned, and the stock market in China a year ago had been one of the worst performing markets in the world since 2006, and certainly relative to the S&P 500. And I thought, you see, we live in a world where there is excessive liquidity that was created by money printing of central banks. And that liquidity will flow from one place of the world to another. It can flow into real estate, can flow into stocks, it can flow into bonds, into collectibles, into art, into commodities. And so the money had flown. The game in town, as people said at the time, was the US stock market. And I felt, relative to the US, China has now become inexpensive. And so we had now recently this huge bull market in Chinese stocks with colossal speculation, I have to say, a lot of speculation. Now, it doesn't mean that the whole thing will collapse and make new lows, but I would imagine that after this burst of volume, of account openings and speculation, we could easily have a significant correction. I mean, I bought China Life, an insurance company. I think I paid around 21 Hong Kong dollars, and now it's close to 40. I mean, it's almost doubled in less than 6 months. And I think it can easily drop 20-30%. I don't think it will make a new low, but it can easily drop 20-30%.
But the US market has way surpassed the 2007 peak, but the Chinese stock market hasn't reached the level reaching 2007. So you think the bull market still have some?
Yes, I mean, Look, different people have different views, but some of my friends, they think that the lows established in the Chinese stock market between, say, June 2014 and November 2014 were major lows, you know, it was generational lows, and that from there the next leg of the bull market is developing. I think it's possible, but equally, as I said, we had a huge run-up, and usually following such a huge run-up, you get a correction. I compare it to some extent to the US bull market after 82. The US stock market bottomed out in August 82. The Dow was below 800, and then it soared into 83, but then 83, 84, we had a meaningful correction. You know, where lots of stocks went down 40%, some 20% and so forth. And then we took off after 84 into 87, and then we had again a big crash in 87 globally. And then we continued to rise until 1990, 1991. We had a correction, and after 94, we had again a huge bull market until March 2000. So it's not a one-way street. All I want to say is, if I were now an individual investor, I would be a little bit careful about putting all my money into Chinese stocks.
Now, the Hong Kong market, the Hong Kong stocks and versus mainland Chinese stocks, if you had the choice to invest in both, which one you like better?
Well, I think it's not so much a question of which market, but which companies. You know, China, like India and the US, there are some good companies, well-managed companies that are also honest, and some less honest companies. And so I think an analyst would really have to analyze very carefully what to buy. Now, my argument was, for most investors, it's easier to invest in Hong Kong shares, and in general, Hong Kong companies are well managed, you understand? And they're mostly clean. I mean, I would say 99% of Hong Kong companies are clean, and they have very professional management. So I have kind of a preference for Hong Kong shares. But the market didn't move much in Hong Kong until a week ago, and then the money came from China and just boom, up like almost 10% in a week. And I'm sure the capital from China will continue to flow into Hong Kong. But the capital from China will not only go into Hong Kong. If you look at direct investment flows, say, into Southeast Asia being essentially everything from Singapore, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, Myanmar, Malaysia, Bangladesh, India, and so forth, the eastern part of the Indian continent. These capital flows, direct investments, is now in many cases lower than in China. And two, there is a political element. As you know, about 2.5 years ago, then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, said that the US would pivot to Asia, in other words, emphasize defense in Asia. And obviously this wasn't perceived by China as particularly nice move, because the Chinese are basically not a threat military to anyone in Asia. They have a country large enough. But obviously they have a huge impact economically. Today, there are 124 countries in the world where China is the largest trading partner. The US has only 74 countries where it is the largest trading partner. So you can see this shift in the balance of economic power from the Western world essentially to China. And the Chinese, of course, they can't allow America to have military bases in Malaysia, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, and so forth. So economically, they're very interested in that region. It's not that they want to occupy Southeast Asia, But they want to make sure that the U.S. is not there. It's bad enough that the U.S. has military bases in the Philippines, in Japan, in South Korea, in Darwin, and so forth.
We'll leave that to the last part of the discussion. But last question about the Chinese stock market. So you mentioned that you bought a Chinese insurance company maybe 6 months ago.
Yes.
So would you buy any Chinese stocks right now? Or would you wait?
Well, I mean, everybody's so negative about the banks. And yes, I think the banks have some problems. But equally, it's a sector that has been neglected. And I wrote last month in my report also about Macau gaming stocks. I don't think there is a rush to buy them, but basically after having declined in some cases by more than 50% from the highs, Macau gaming companies are probably in a buying range. And concerning properties, I'm sure there will be some good value in also Chinese property companies. I prefer to play the Chinese property market through Hong Kong companies that have developments in China or Singapore companies.
Would you actually, you know, buy them now or would you wait?
As I told you, I think we have had a burst of speculative activity. And I would rather now wait for a correction. But the problem with many markets has been, because of this colossal liquidity that is in the world, has been that if something moved or began to move, there was no correction. It just went one way, like the yen weakness or the euro weakness. It just went very far. Or oil was 8 months ago, still close to $100, it dropped to around 40. Now it's rebounding somewhat. So these moves, central banks, in principle, one of their mandates is price stability. But what they've created is colossal price instability with big moves in markets that actually have a negative impact on business, because the entrepreneurs find it very difficult to have any planning.
So it seems like we're in the middle of the bubble of the century.
Well, it depends how we measure a bubble, but the stock market in the US bottomed out March 6, 2009. So we're 6 years into bull market, more than 6 years now. And the economy in the U.S. bottomed out in June 2009, so we're 6 years into an economic expansion. By any standard, this is a very long expansion and a very long bull market. And in the process of that, stocks have become inflated. Not everywhere, say in Russia, stocks are deflated, or in Brazil. And some properties are also deflating, and some properties are going up. I mean, I just received yesterday, just to show you how bubbles work, someone sent me from Australia some homes with pictures in a city that is close to coal mines. Mm-hmm. The prices are down something like 60% from the peak because the coal industry is not doing well. And so these bubbles, they have actually economically, certainly in the long run, a negative impact. Now, talking about a bubble, yes, if you add all the stock market capitalization in the world and you add the borrowings in the world, credit, the bond market capitalization, yes, by that definition, today global debts as a percent of the economy are far higher than in 2007. They're up something like, I think, $57 trillion, according to figures supplied by the IMF and McKinsey. So, yes, we are in an, you know, recently they sold a Gauguin painting in Europe, $300 million for a Gauguin. This is a colossal asset inflation.
Now, let's come back to China and then talk about China's currency, the RMB. China has moved very quickly during the past couple of years to push the RMB internationalization process. Their next move, some people say the RMB might become convertible this year, next year, or next 5 years. How do you think China ought to manage this process?
Well, I think they moved the right way, namely slowly. But the aim of China, and not only China, but also of other emerging economies, is basically to start trading and settling accounts outside of the dollar block. Because until recently, say, if I'm here in Thailand and I want to send money to someone in Brazil, it didn't go from Thailand to Brazil, it went through New York money center banks. I think over time, China wants to settle its external trade in local currency or in the currency they trade with Brazil or in Brazilian reals, not in US dollars. And I think this process of a diminished role of the US dollar within global trade and within the world, also geopolitically, is an ongoing process that is irreversible. And I suppose that one day China will be a much more important currency. Let's say in Hong Kong you can now pay in all the shops in yuan. In Thailand it's not yet that accepted, but they say if you walk into a shop with a $100 bill, they'll take it right away. They know exactly the exchange rate. With Chinese currency, maybe in some shops they would know, but not everywhere. And I think eventually in Asia, the yuan will be a very important currency. But I doubt we will have in Asia a currency that is like the euro, because I just can't see how Japan would sit on the negotiating table with China and South Korea, you understand? So I think, yes, the Chinese currency will become a much more important currency. And I believe this is one reason that when, say, the economy slows down meaningfully, China may be reluctant to print money the way Japan did it and lower the value of the RMB. Because my view would be that China's desire is to show to the world we have a stable currency.
So you do agree with the central bankers, the Chinese central banks, who say that they want to keep the RMB stable, while even everybody else seems to believe that they want to depreciate the currency?
Well, I mean, I agree with any central banker who considers currency stability to be a priority. And I think the Bank of China, with its desire to essentially maintain stability of the currency, is the right policy. I believe to try to boost economic growth by depreciating your currency is one of the most ridiculous ideas that an economist can have. But this is precisely what the central banks in Europe, in Japan, in the US, and everywhere have done. In my view, these people belong into a xylem of crazy people.
But specifically, how do you see the RMB going to move for the short term?
Well, I believe that will depend on numerous factors. One thing I'd like to remind you, in the Asian crisis of 97-98, all Asian currencies basically went down against the US dollar meaningfully, but not the Chinese currency. They maintained stability. And it was, in some cases, it involved some pain because the rest of Asia became very competitive for a while. But that was then offset later on. And now I believe that if other Asian countries would really follow the example of Japan and in a moment of madness try to boost their economies through a depreciation of the currency, that maybe China, if the economic conditions in China were very weak, that is the precondition, unless if there is a credit collapse, you know, an economic crisis. If there isn't, I don't think the Chinese will move with monetary measures to lower the value of the currency. That I doubt, because they have probably more to lose by doing so than by imposing some economic hardship on the people for a few years.
But for the long term, 5 years, 10 years later, the RMB will still appreciate against the dollar.
Well, that's a good question. Some people are very bullish about the US dollar and they think that there is a cyclical up move in dollars and that the dollar will stay strong for the next 5 to 10 years. That is not my view. I believe if the dollar continues to strengthen here, what will happen is that the Fed will initiate another easing program, you know, those QE4, QE5 and so forth, to lower the value of the dollar. There's a misconception in the world when people talk about currency wars. There's no currency war. There is coordinated policies by central bankers to essentially print money. So the US starts, the Africans, they go to Japan and say, why don't you do now? So they hand over the baton to Japan. So the Japanese then print, and then they also force Draghi, why don't you print? The euro is too strong, so let's print in Europe as well, and so forth and so on. So they're passing each other their mad monetary policies. And it is conceivable that China will not participate, that they will rather take the hardship. Besides that, even if the dollar would decline, or say, well, put it another way, if the Chinese currency appreciates, say, another 20% against the Japanese yen and against the euro and so forth, I don't think that it's a disaster for China, because they buy resources. Then they process these resources and they sell the finished products on somewhere else in the world. So with a strong currency, they buy cheaper resources than other countries. And therefore, my inclination is to think that the Chinese will not print money.
Closely connected to that question is China's capital accounts and how do the government manage to open up its capital accounts. And we had last year, 2014, estimated $324 billion of capital outflows from China. And that trend is continuing into this first quarter of 2015. How concerned are you about capital outflows?
Well, it depends what they're used for. You know, if say money leaves the country to build a factory in Vietnam or in Myanmar or something like this, then it's not a problem. If the capital leaves to just buy homes in San Francisco and Vancouver and so forth, I don't think it's a very useful allocation of resources. But we live in a basically a free world and in a capitalistic system. Each person has a choice to do with his money whatever he wants.
I guess the concern is a loss of confidence in China. And
yeah, I mean, but I don't think it's really a loss of confidence. But many Chinese families, if they have children, they can see that the children can grow up in clean air in Sydney or in Melbourne, and they grow up in pollution in Beijing. And so it's in many cases a lifestyle choice. And also I'd like to point out, Europeans, they have investments in the United States and they have investments in Australia and in Asia, everywhere and so forth. And it's natural that China, due to its size, has also some investments around the world.
So you're not...
I'm not overly concerned.
What happens?
You know, some people will say, well, this shows a lack of confidence of Chinese in their economic system. Well, I mean, I can tell you in America, if Americans really had a choice, 90% would probably also invest overseas, but it's becoming more difficult for Americans to have accounts overseas. So I don't buy entirely the argument that the capital is leaving China because of loss of confidence in China. I think it's partly diversification. Some people have made a lot of money and they want to have some assets in another jurisdiction. I think it's like, I'm Swiss, I don't have all my money in Switzerland. I have some in Asia and some in Canada and so forth. But I think it's a prudent diversification.
If China were to open up its capital accounts today, what do you think would happen?
Well, if there was a complete open capital account, I would imagine that the currency would rather appreciate than depreciate. Because a lot of money has left also because the capital account is closed. In other words, if you open it, some money will flow back because they know we can do something in China, and if conditions change, we can take it out. But if you can't take it out, then actually it's an incentive to take it out.
Many people say that China's society and economy lacks resilience. They are vulnerable to shocks and also unexpected events. What are the odds that you would put on a disaster type of scenario that happened in China?
Well, we have to put everything into proper perspective. I mean, I always tell Americans, look, you may say that the Japanese economy didn't grow for the last 30 years, which is largely true, but per capita incomes in real terms, inflation adjusted, have done about as well as in the US. Number two, the Japanese, they have a different society than other societies. For them, social cohesion is a very important fact, and the quality of life is a very important factor. So if you have a Fukushima accident in Japan, is there any looting? There's no looting at all. People help each other. But in America, you have every light fire somewhere, you have a light earthquake somewhere, looting starts right away. And that is a different society. Now, if someone tells me, oh, the Chinese society is not resilient, I think this is nonsense. On the contrary, Western society has gone soft. People lose their jobs. They want to have unemployment benefits. They have disability. They have a headache. They want disability insurance. Because they claim they can't work. They have a headache when working. I also have headaches when working. But I still have to work. And so I believe Asian societies, and in particular the Chinese, are very resilient.
But I mean, we do see much more frequent protests, social unrest, and violence, particularly in the western parts of China. You're not concerned about that spreading to much wider?
Well, again, we have to put this in perspective. China has 1.3 billion people. So naturally, with this population, you have more unrest than in Switzerland with 7 million people. You understand? It's just the scale. As a percentage of the population, actually, the unrest is limited. In the western part of China, we have, it's maybe not politically correct to say so, but we have a Muslim problem. In Ukraine, we had a revolution, basically. But who was behind the revolution? The Western powers, they fed money and encouraged to move against at the time, not particularly Russia-friendly, but nevertheless cooperating with Russia government, because they wanted to extend NATO into Ukraine. In China, I could easily see that some powers have an interest to create unrest in China. I mean, if I were an American, I wanted to contain China, I would create a revolution in China, if that was my objective. It's not my objective, and I think it would be wrong. But you understand? There are lots of people who have an interest that China fails. Number two, with the anti-corruption drive, I can imagine that President Xi Jinping has lost a lot of friends in high places and powerful people. I mean, he needs a very good personal security apparatus. Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, if you've been disposed and taken, put into jail and all your assets have been taken, you're not going to treat him very nicely.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Yes, my pleasure. Thank you.